Welcome to Shiur on Svarno, Parsha Shmos. The Shiur this evening is sponsored by David Kulik in memory of his grandfather, Morris Press, Moshe Ben Zachariah. It's also sponsored, along with all of the Shiurim this week, by Joel and Elke Hershkowitz in memory of his father, Moshe Ephraim, Reb Yoel Hershkowitz. That the families are involved in. We introduced some of the Svarno's comments in the beginning of Parshas Shmos yesterday, and I'd like to draw attention particularly to the following two ideas, and we'll continue sort of elaborating on those ideas tonight. First of all, an idea that the Svarno had discussed back in Breishis, and he elaborates on this in Shmos, is the fact that the Shibud, the enslavement in Egypt, was brought about directly as a result of the low spiritual level of the Jewish people. As long as the Jewish people were able to maintain a high spiritual level in Egypt, as long as the Shvatim and their descent and their children were alive, so the Jewish people were on that spiritual level, they were not able to be enslaved. Once the Shvatim died, and Klal Yisrael began to veer from the path of Torah and Mitzvos while they were in Mitzrayim, meaning Torah and Mitzvos in the broadest sense of the term, their commitment to one God and the covenant that he had made with the Jewish people. Once they began to veer from that and to worship other idols and the like, so then that's when the Egyptians responded in kind by persecuting the Jewish people. And that's a theme which we'll see developed a little bit later tonight. The second theme, which is interesting and unique to the Svarno, is that the original plan of Paro and his henchmen was not to enslave or certainly to commit any kind of genocide against the Jewish people while they were in Egypt. Originally, what Paro was hoping for was to drive the Jewish people out of Egypt. They should just get out of here and leave us alone. The Svarno understands the Pasuk, which ends with the words, "Ve'olam min ha'aretz," they will leave the land, as being not Paro's fear of what might happen, but rather Paro's hopes as to what should happen. Havan is chakmalo. Let's deal with them wisely, and hopefully, if we play our cards right, va'olam in ha'aretz will make life so miserable for the Jewish people here in Mitzrayim that they'll be running out of here. And if they run out of here, we'll be the happiest people in the world. God should bless the Jews and keep them very far away from us. That was the perspective, according to the Svarno, that Paro had in the very beginnings of the enslavement of the Jewish people. So initially, as we saw, the Egyptians do not enslave the Jewish people. They place upon them taxes. Leman anoso b'sivlosam. In order to torture them in their sufferings. In other words, there's a tax, there's a working tax. They're not enslaved, but they're obligated to work for the kingdom. And the Svarno writes in Pasuk Yud Aleph, "Kidei she'yaskimu latzeis el eretz acheres." The hope of Paro was that the Jews would be driven out of the land because of that. But what happened? So the Jews willingly built the treasure houses of Pisom and Ramses, the treasure cities of Pisom and Ramses for Paro. And they displayed that they were not about to leave the land. So then the pasuk goes on to say in Yud Gimel, "Vayavidu Mitzrayim es b'nei Yisrael b'farech." The Egyptians made the Jewish people work with backbreaking labor. I think when we read that pasuk generally, we think, okay, that's just a summary of what's been going on up till now. After all, they were building these cities for Paro, and they were doing so with backbreaking labor. The Svarno understands, in contrast, that this is a second stage. Initially, they were hoping to just drive the Jews out of the land. However, the Svarno writes, "Kishero osam evazim atzman lepeula pechusa." When the Egyptians saw that the Jews not only were not leaving the land, but they were willingly accepting all of these types of menial labor, "Samu osam lavadim." They made them into slaves. Vayavidu Mitzrayim. The Egyptians enslaved the Jews was not what happened initially. Initially they just said, you have an obligation to work for the government. And they were hoping they would leave. They didn't leave. So the Egyptians turned around and they said, look, if you're not leaving, so we're stuck with you, at least we should treat you on a lower level, because again, we're afraid that you'll be a fifth column. So it's only after the Jews refuse to leave that they're made into slaves. And that came about, says the Svarno, Rezek kefish ma shehayu mosifin chatos al chatos. The enslavement of the Jewish people corresponded to the fact that the Jewish people themselves were getting themselves deeper and deeper into sin. Kein avdo atzasam v'yotzu meira ara. The more the Jewish people sinned, the more the Egyptians acted cruelly and in an evil fashion towards them. And that indeed, says the Sfarno, is the next pasuk. Vayimaru es chayeyem b'avoda kasha. Pasuk that's famous to us from the Haggadah Shel Pesach. The Egyptians embittered their lives with difficult work, b'chomer v'olveinim, v'chol avoda b'asodah, with bricks, with mortar, with every kind of work that was out in the field. The Sfarno understands this is yet a third level of enslavement. Originally they were slaves, okay, but to be a slave and to work bitterly are not necessarily synonymous. A slave can have a relatively peaceful and comfortable life. You know, a lot of whether slavery is positive or negative for the slave depends on the slave owner and how the slave owner treats the slave. Throughout history, there were certainly slaves who were treated well. And again, while they didn't have their freedom, they weren't physically suffering in quite the same sense that someone who's treated badly is physically suffering. Initially, the Jews were made into slaves. Vayavidu Mitzrayim es b'nei Yisrael b'farach. But then, a second stage, Vayumaru es chayeyem, the Egyptians not only made them into slaves, but they made their lives bitter. They treated them poorly as slaves. And that's the Svarno goes on to say in Pasuk Yudalit, in explaining this next stage. Kasher hosifu lachto, as the Jewish people continued sinning, b'deyos uvamaisim, in terms of their philosophies, in terms of their acts, kemo shehed hanavi, as Yechezkel hanavi speaks about, again, the Svarno comes back to these psukim, Yechezkel perek chof, very much over and over again. The Novi Yechezkel says that Vayamru bi v'lo avu l'shma elai. The Jewish people betrayed me. They didn't want to listen to me. V'omar l'shma chamosi aleim l'chalos api bohem b'soch eretz Mitzrayim. Says Hashem, it was my intention to pour out my anger upon them while they were in Egypt. In other words, the Sfarno uses this as the basis of his idea that the Jewish people, while they were in Egypt, had very much rejected HaKadosh Baruch Hu by and large. So they were being punished. And indeed, the hand of their enemies, the Egyptians, got stronger and stronger against them the more the Jewish people continued to sin. This theme of the sinfulness of the Jewish people and how they very much rejected HaKadosh Baruch Hu while they were in Mitzrayim comes out a little bit later in the parasha as well, towards the end of Perek Beis. So, in the end of Perek Beis, it describes how the king of Egypt died. And it says, Perek Beis, Pasuk Chof Gimel, Vayizaku b'nei, how's it go? Vayomas melech Mitzrayim, Vayayonchu b'nei Yisrael minho avodo vayizaku. The king of Egypt died. The Jewish people groaned from their labors and they cried out. So comments the Sfarno on that. Zaku mikeev lev al avodasam. They cried out because they were so burdened with all of their work. And the pasuk continues, Vatal shavasam elo elkim in ha'avoda. Their cries went up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Says the Sfarno, Lo bishvil tshuvasam usfilasam. It's not that the Jewish people engaged in tshuva. It's not that the Jewish people engaged in tefillah, in prayer. They just cried out. They couldn't take it anymore. It wasn't an act of tshuva. It wasn't an act of tefillah. They simply cried out of desperation. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu heard their desperation. But again, even at this late stage, the Jewish people are estranged from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They're not engaging in tshuva. They're not engaging in tefillah. The only thing, the pasuk continues, is that some of the Jewish people were still on the right path. The next pasuk says, Hashem listened to their cries and says the Sfarno on that, Tfilas ktsasam, the tfilah of some of the Jewish people, shispalalu oz tzadikei hador, the tzadikim of that generation cried out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They actually prayed, but the people as a whole, you know, even at that stage, we're not engaging in tshuva, we're not engaging in tefillah. It would take something much more traumatic in order to convince the Jewish people to turn back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Again, the picture that the Sfarno paints is very much one of a Jewish people which is estranged from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I want to turn our attention to the beginning of Perek Beis, where the Chumash describes the story of the birth and the youth of Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Perek starts off describing how Moshe Rabbeinu was born. Vatayr ho'isha, Yocheved became pregnant. Vateilat bein, she had a son. Vateira oso kitovu, she saw that he was good. Vatitzbereu shlosha yirachim, and she hid him for 3 months to hide him from the eyes of the Egyptian police. What does it mean, Vateira oso kitovu, she saw that he was good? So we're familiar with the famous Rashi. Rashi quoting from the Gemara writes, Kishenolad nismali habayis kula ora, she saw that he was good insofar as when he was born, there was a miraculous light that filled up the entire house. The Sfarno approaches this pasuk from a much more pshat-based perspective, but it's a perspective which is quite interesting. He writes as follows, Raso yofa yoser mimasha hayo murgo. She saw, Yocheved saw, that Moshe was an unusually good-looking baby. Vatero so kitovu, she saw that he was good. Right? He was like, I guess all babies are cute, really, especially if you're the mother of the baby. But I guess even by the standards of cute babies, Moshe was a particularly good-looking baby. V'chashva shezeh hayu l'tachlis mechuvon me'es yotzra. And as Yocheved saw that he was unusually well-formed and unusually good-looking, she said to herself, this is some kind of divine sign that he's destined for greatness, that he's destined for something great. And the Sfarno adds, Ki omnom yofi hatavnis yore altuv mezeg hachomer ushlemus hakoach hametzayer. Having a good physique, being good and beautiful in the way in which the person is formed, shows a certain perfection on a spiritual level, and it shows that the koach hametzayer, the ability to conjure up images and to have a healthy imagination, which apparently is something that you need to be a Navi, was very, very strong in him. It's a very interesting comment. I'm not sure what to make of it other than just to note the comment. But the Sfarno here is clearly linking, at least in some cases, a person's physical appearance to his spiritual qualities. Yocheved looked at Moshe Rabbeinu, the baby, and she saw that there was something special about his appearance that made her think that this baby is destined for great things, and perhaps even this baby has the wherewithal to become a great Navi, a great prophet. How do you do that exactly? Don't ask me. Certainly I don't have the answer to that question, but it's an interesting insight that sometimes, at least, I guess not all of the time, the Gemara famously says that Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, the famous Tana, was a very ugly man, was not a good-looking person at all, to the point where the empress's daughter commented on his ugliness. So, you know, you see, it doesn't always, you know, there's not always a correlation between the physical and the spiritual, but at least in certain contexts, you know, the physical appearance of Moshe Rabbeinu may, as a baby, made his mother think that there must be something great that this individual is destined for. Okay, so, you know, we know the story. She ultimately, after hiding him for 3 months, places him by the Nile River. Basparo finds him. And the pasuk says that Vatiftach, the daughter of Paro, finds the little box in which this baby is enclosed. Vatiftach, she opens it up. Vatir'eyos hayeled, she saw the child. And again, consistent with what he said before, the Sforno writes, Vatera oso kitovhu v'yofe me'od. She saw that, again, whatever Yocheved saw in Moshe Rabbeinu that made him physically look unusual in a positive sense, that he had this extraordinary physical appearance. So Basparo was struck by this extraordinary physical appearance as well. And then the pasuk says, V'hine na'ar boche. She saw the yeled, she saw the child, and behold, there was a young lad who was crying. So already Rashi, the other Mefarshim, pick up on this oddity in the pasuk. Initially in the pasuk, Moshe Rabbeinu, the baby, is called a yeled, a little child. And then just a few words later, he's referred to as a na'ar, as a young lad, as a young boy. What do we make of that switch from yeled to na'ar? So the Sfarah has the following comment. V'ra'asa, she saw, she'im hayoso yeled hayo na'ar boche. Despite the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was a little child, the yeled, the crying was reminiscent of a na'ar, of a young boy. V'zeh, meaning, ki avlad me'esi valdo ar hayose sholem begido yikare yeled. From the time an infant is born until he's completed his growth process, he's referred to as a yeled. Umeyes heyoso misna'er umisno'eya bitchnuos bilti shlemos lahasig tachlis yikare na'ar. But when this child begins to move around, the word to move around is lehisna'er. When the child begins to move around and take tentative steps to try to achieve something, so at that point he's called a na'ar, from the word lehisna'er. Na'ar means the one who moves. So just to translate what I think the Sfarno is saying over here, a child doesn't really have any ambitions. What are the child's ambitions? The child's ambitions are, I want to go to recess. Yeah, I want to play, I want to have a good time. That's what a child wants to do with life. And as long as the child doesn't really have ambitions, he's called the yeled, he's growing up. The minute the child begins to have ambitions, he starts moving around and looking to try to accomplish something, what we would call, I guess today, an adolescent. So at that point, he becomes a na'ar. A na'ar in the sense of someone who wants to do something and is moving. Again, na'ar lehisno'er. He's moving around. He's grasping. He's moving in a certain direction to try to accomplish something. Now again, he's not an accomplished person. He's still an adolescent. If he had accomplished it, he wouldn't be considered a na'ar. A na'ar means somebody who's in process. But at least the na'ar has an ambition and something that he's looking to try to fulfill. And the Sforno adds, based on that, we can explain an interesting phenomenon in Hebrew. Umize yikare kol mishores na'ar. Because of this understanding that na'ar means someone who has ambitions and is trying and has not yet completed or fulfilled those ambitions, he's trying to fulfill those ambitions. That's why in Lashon Kodesh we refer to a servant as a na'ar. Right? So to take an example, Yoshua ben Nun is referred to as the na'ar, as the servant of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now if you make the calculation as to how old Yoshua was when he's referred to as a Na'ar, he was into his 50s when he was called a Na'ar, the Na'ar of Moshe Rabbeinu. What do you mean he's a Na'ar? He's not an adolescent. He's a grown man. Why are you calling him a Na'ar? So we have this phenomenon in Hebrew that anyone who's a servant is called a Na'ar. Okay, but why does that make sense? Why is there one word for a servant and also for an adolescent? Why is it the same word? So the Sfarno writes, Ki omnom rov tnuosov bilti shlemos, kifi atzorich lahasiga tachlis hamechuvon la'adonov. So, since, generally speaking, the servant is never successful in meeting the demands of the master, it's an interesting comment, right? The master always has greater aspirations and demands of the servant than the servant is actually able to fulfill. So that means the servant is always moving around, na'ar. He has aspirations, he has things he wants to do, but he's never quite complete in fulfilling those objectives and aspirations. You know, a servant, an assistant, is stuck in eternal adolescence, in that sense of the term. He's always going to be a na'ar, he's always going to be somebody who has a lot of things to do, but is never quite able to accomplish them all. So, interesting linguistic insight from the Sfarno. In any case, so the Pasuk starts off referring to this baby, Moshe Rabbeinu, as a Yeled, then refers to him as a Na'ar. How do you account for this shift? So the Sfarno says as follows. Omarim came, Shirasa Shim Heyoso Yeled, Nolad Mikorov, Hine Hoyo Na'ar Boche, Misna'er Betsnua Nifla Ami Ben Gilo. There was something extraordinary about Moshe Rabbeinu, says the Sfarno, and Basparo picked up on this. It was clear that he was a Yeled biologically. He was an infant. He was 3 months old. He had barely been born. But there was something about the way he presented himself, even as a three-month-old, that was more reminiscent of a Na'ar, of an adolescent, somebody who had an aspiration and was moving around sort of impatiently to try to achieve that objective. Now again, what that looked like, I really don't know. I can't imagine. It's hard to imagine looking at a three-month-old baby and thinking, wow, this kid is going places. But apparently, according to the Sfarno, that's what Basparo picked up when she looked at this little infant who was destined to be Moshe Rabbeinu. There was something about his physical appearance, Vateroso Kitovu. There was something about the way he moved, that he wasn't just this cute little infant, but you could see that he had a sense of purpose, a sense of objective. Again, what does that mean in a three-month-old? I don't know. But there was something incredibly unique about Moshe Rabbeinu, the baby, which made an impression on Basparo, and that's, the Sfarno explains, what moved Basparo to take this child whom she knew was one of the Jewish children who was supposed to be thrown into the Nile. Her father had said, throw all these baby boys into the Nile. She knew that she was going against her father's wishes, but there was something just so extraordinary and striking about the baby that she felt she had to save him and keep him as her own. Then she names him Moshe. Right? So what's pshat in Moshe? So the Pasuk says, Vatikro Shmo Moshe, Pasuk Yod, because I drew him out of the water. And the Sfarno, and we've spoken about this Sfarno in the past in different contexts, makes the following observation. Moshe means Mimaleit Umoshe es Acherim Mitzara. Moshe does not mean, as is often translated, the one drawn from the water. Right? You would think on the surface that's what Moshe means, right? Kimina Maimish Yisihu, I drew him from the water. So Moshe means the one who was drawn from the water. But grammatically, that would not be correct. The one drawn from the water would be referred to in Lashon Kodesh as Moshui, the one drawn. What's Moshe? Moshe is an active verb. It's not a passive verb. Moshe means the one who draws others, the one who draws others out of situations of difficulty. And the Sfarno goes on to explain, putting the words into the mouth of Basparo, Hatam Shikrosiv Moshe. The reason that I called this baby Moshe, the one who redeems and draws others out of difficulty, is laharos shiyamalit esacherim hu. It's a sign that this child is going to save others. Ki omnom mishisiu min amayim achar shayomuto besocham. I drew him from the water. Vizelo hoyokim bigzeiras irin. But obviously the fact that I found him in the water and I pulled him out of the water was some kind of divinely orchestrated decree. Kadeshi Malit hu esacherim. I see, it's some kind of hashkacha, she said, that I'm drawing him out of the water in order that in the future he will draw others out of the water. So in other words, she's giving him a name not based on what happened, but really based on what she predicts the future for this little baby is going to be. Once again, this is one piece with the ideas the Sforno has developed, that this little three-month-old baby left this incredible impression on Bas Paro, this extraordinary impression on Bas Paro. She was blown away by this little kid somehow, right? And she said, I see in his future that he's going to somehow draw other people out of difficult and terrible situations. She just felt something about this little kid. It also speaks to the idea we mentioned yesterday from the Sforno, that for the Sforno, the biggest type of tzidkus, of piety, is a person who's able to have an influence on others. So Moshe is so called because of what he's able to do for others. He's not just a moshui, he's not just someone who's pulled out of the water, he's someone who in turn is going to pull other people out of the water and have that kind of incredible impact on them and on their lives. Okay, Rabbi Hanan ben Akasha Omer.